47. Mr. Hodges has 1,000 questions, but Pete has no time to answer any of them. He ends the call and sprints down Sycamore Street to his house. He has decided getting Tina's old wagon will take too long. He'll figure out some other way to transport the notebooks when he gets to the wreck. All he really needs is the key to the building. He runs into his father's office to grab it and stops cold. His mother is on the floor beside the desk, her blue eyes shining from a mask of blood. There's more blood on his dad's open laptop, on the front of her dress, spattered on the desk chair and the window behind her. Music is tinkling from the computer, and even in his distress, he recognizes the tune. She was playing solitaire. Just playing solitaire and waiting for her kid to come home and bothering no one.
Mom!
He runs to her, crying. My head, she says. Look at my head. He bends over her, parts bloody clumps of hair, trying to be gentle, and sees a trench running from her temple to the back of her head. At one point, halfway along the trench, he can see bleary gray-white. It's her skull, he thinks. That's bad, but at least it's not her brains. Please God, no. Brains are soft. Brains would be leaking. It's just her skull. A man came, she says, speaking with great effort. He took Tina. I heard her cry out. You have to. Oh, Jesus Christ, how my head rings. Pete hesitates for one endless second, wavering between his need to help his mother and his need to protect his sister to get her back. If only this was a nightmare, he thinks. If only I could wake up. Mom first. Mom right now. He grabs the phone off his father's desk. Be quiet, Mom. Don't say anything else, and don't move. She closes her eyes wearily.
Did he come for the money? Did that man come for the money you found?
No, for what was with it, Pete says, and punches in 3 numbers he learned in grade school.
911, the woman says. What is your emergency?
My mom's been shot, Pete says. 23 Sycamore Street. Send an ambulance right now. She's bleeding like crazy.
What is your name, son?
Pete hangs up. Mom, I have to go. I have to get Tina back.
Don't be hurt.
She's slurring now. Her eyes are still shut, and he sees with horror that there's even blood in her eyelashes. This is his fault. All his fault.
Don't let Tina be hurt.
She falls silent, but she's breathing. Oh, God, please let her keep breathing. Pete takes the key to the Birch Street Rec's front door from his father's real estate properties board. You'll be okay, Mom. The ambulance will come. Some friends will come, too. He starts for the door. Then an idea strikes him and he turns back. Mom?
What?
Does Dad still smoke?
Without opening her eyes, she says, he thinks. I don't know.
Quickly, he has to be gone before Hodges gets here and tries to stop him from doing what he has to do. Pete begins to search the drawers of his father's desk. Just in case, he thinks. Just in case. 48. The back gate is ajar. Pete doesn't notice. He pelts down the path. As he nears the stream, he passes a scrap of filmy yellow cloth hanging from a branch jutting out into the path. He reaches the stream and turns to look, almost without realizing it, at the spot where the trunk is buried. The trunk that caused all this horror. When he reaches the stepping stones at the bottom of the bank, Pete suddenly stops. His eyes widen. His legs go rubbery and loose. He sits down hard, staring at the foaming, shallow water that he has crossed so many times, often with his little sister babbling away about whatever interested her at the time. Mrs. Beasley, SpongeBob, her friend Ellen, her favorite lunchbox, her favorite clothes. The filmy yellow blouse with the billowing sleeves, for instance. Mom tells her she shouldn't wear it so often because it has to be dry-cleaned. Was Teens wearing it this morning when she left for school? That seems like a century ago, but he thinks she was. I'm taking her to a safe place, Red Lips had said. A place where we can meet once you have the notebooks. Can it be? Of course it can. If Red Lips grew up in Pete's house, he would have spent time at the wreck. All the kids in the neighborhood spent time there until it closed, and he must have known about the path because the trunk was buried less than 20 paces from where it crossed the stream. But he doesn't know about the notebooks, Pete thinks. Not yet. Unless he found out since the last call, that is. If so, he will have taken them already. He'll be gone. That would be okay if he's left Tina alive. And why wouldn't he? What reason would he have to kill her once he has what he wants? For revenge, Pete thinks coldly. To get back at me. I'm the thief who took the notebooks. I hit him with a bottle and got away at the bookstore, and I deserve to be punished. He gets up and staggers as a wave of lightheadedness rushes through him. When it passes, he crosses the creek. On the other side, he begins to run again. 49. The front door of 23 Sycamore is standing open. Hodges is out of the Mercedes before Jerome has brought it fully to a stop. He runs inside, one hand in his pocket, gripping the happy slapper. He hears tinkly music he knows well from hours spent playing computer solitaire. He follows the sound and finds a woman sitting, sprawling, beside a desk in an alcove that has been set up as an office. One side of her face is swollen and drenched in blood. She looks at him, trying to focus.
Pete, she says, and then, he took Tina.
Hodges kneels and carefully parts the woman's hair. What he sees is bad, but nowhere near as bad as it could be. This woman has won the only lottery that really matters. The bullet put a groove 6 inches long in her scalp, has actually exposed her skull in one place, but a scalp wound isn't going to kill her. She's lost a lot of blood, though, and is suffering from both shock and concussion. This is no time to question her, but he has to. Morris Bellamy is laying down a trail of violence, and Hodges is still at the wrong end of it. Holly, call an ambulance.
Pete already did,
Linda says, and as if her weak voice has conjured it, they hear a siren. It's still distant, but approaching fast.
Before he left.
Mrs. Salbers, did Pete take Tina? Is that what you're saying?
No. He. The man.
Did he have red lips, Mrs. Salbers? Holly asks. Did the man who took Tina have red lips?
Irish lips, she says. But not a redhead. White. He was old. Am I going to die?
No, Hodges says. Help is on the way, but you have to help us. Do you know where Peter went?
Out. Back. Through the gate. Saw him.
Jerome looks out the window and sees the gate standing ajar. What's back there?
A path,
she says wearily.
The kids used it to go to the wreck before it closed. I think he took the key.
Pete did?
Yes.
Her eyes move to a board with a great many keys hung on it. One hook is empty. The dymo tape beneath it reads Birch Street Wreck. Hodges comes to a decision. Jerome, you're with me. Holly, stay with Mrs. Salbers. Get a cold cloth to put on the side of her head. He draws in a breath. But before you do that, call the police. Ask for my old partner, Huntley. He expects an argument, but Holly just nods and picks up the phone.
He took his father's lighter, too,
Linda says. She seems a little more with it now.
I don't know why he would do that, and the can of Ronson's.
Jerome looks a question at Hodges, who says, it's lighter fluid.
50. Pete keeps to the shade of the trees, just as Morris and Tina did. Although the boys who were playing basketball have gone home to dinner and left the court deserted except for a few crows scavenging spilled potato chips, he sees a small car nestled in the loading dock. Hidden there, actually. And the vanity license plate is enough to cause any doubts Pete might have had to disappear. Red Lips is here, all right, and he can't have taken Tina in by the front. That door faces the street, which is apt to be fairly busy at this time of day, and besides, he has no key. Pete passes the car
and at the corner of the building, he drops to his knees and peers around. One of the basement windows is open. The grass and weeds that were growing in front of it have been beaten down. He hears a man's voice. They're down there, all right. So are the notebooks. The only question is whether or not Red Lips has found them yet. Pete withdraws and leans against the sun-warmed brick, wondering what to do next. Think, he tells himself. You got Tina into this and you need to get her out of it, so think, goddamn you! Only he can't, his mind is full of white noise. In one of his few interviews, the ever-irritable John Rothstein expressed his disgust with the where-do-you-get-your-ideas question. Story ideas came from nowhere, he proclaimed. They arrived without the polluting influence of the author's intellect. The idea that comes to Pete now also seems to arrive from nowhere. It's both horrible and horribly attractive. It won't work if Red Lips has already discovered the notebooks, but if that is the case, nothing will work. Pete gets up and circles the big brick cube the other way, once more passing the green car with its tattletale license plate. He stops at the front right corner of the abandoned brick box looking at the going-home traffic on Birch Street. It's like peering through a window and into a different world, one where things are normal. He takes a quick inventory, cell phone, cigarette lighter, can of lighter fluid. The can was in the bottom desk drawer with his father's Zippo. The can is only half full based on the slosh when he shakes it, but half full will be more than enough. He goes around the corner, now in full view of Birch Street, trying to walk normally and hoping that no one, Mr. Evans, his old Little League coach, for instance, will hail him. No one does. This time he knows which of the two keys to use, and this time it turns easily in the lock. He opens the door slowly, steps into the foyer, and eases the door closed. It's musty and brutally hot in here. For Tina's sake, he hopes it's cooler in the basement. How scared she must be, he thinks. If she's still alive to feel anything, an evil voice whispers back. Red Lips could have been standing over her dead body and talking to himself. He's crazy, and that's what crazy people do. On Pete's left, a flight of stairs leads up to the second floor, which consists of a single large space running the length of the building. The official name was the North Side Community Room, but the kids had a different name for it, one Red Lips probably remembers. As Pete sits on the stairs to take off his shoes, he can't be heard clacking and echoing across the floor. He thinks again, I got her into this. It's my job to get her out, nobody else's. He calls his sister's cell. From below him, muffled but unmistakable, he hears Tina's Snow Patrol ringtone. Red Lips answers immediately. Hello, Peter. He sounds calmer now. In control. That could be good or bad for his plan. Pete can't tell which. Have you got the notebooks? Yes. Is my sister okay?
She's fine. Where are you?
That's pretty funny, Pete says, and when you think about it, it actually is. Jimmy Gold would like it, I bet.
I'm in no mood for cryptic humor.
Let us do our business and be done with each other, shall we? Where are you? Do you remember the Saturday movie palace?
What are you?
Red Lips stops. Thinks.
Are you talking about the community room where they used to show all those corny...
He pauses again as the penny drops.
You're here?
Yes, and you're in the basement. I saw the car out back. You were maybe 90 feet from the notebooks all along. Even closer than that, Pete thinks. Come and get them. He ends the call before Red Lips can try to set the terms more to his liking. Pete runs for the kitchen on tiptoe, shoes in hand. He has to get out of sight before Red Lips can climb the stairs from the basement. If he does that, all may be well. If he doesn't, he and his sister will probably die together. From downstairs, louder than her ringtone, much louder, he hears Tina cry out in pain. Still alive, Pete thinks, and then, the bastard hurt her. Only that's not the truth. I did it. This is all my fault. Mine, mine, mine.
51. Morris, sitting on a box marked Kitchen Supplies, closes Tina's phone and at first only looks at it. There's but one question on the floor, really, just one that needs to be answered. Is the boy telling the truth, or is he lying? Morris thinks he's telling the truth. They both grew up on Sycamore Street, after all, and they both attended Saturday movie shows upstairs, sitting on folding chairs and eating popcorn sold by the local Girl Scout troop. It's logical to think they would both choose this nearby abandoned building as a place to hide, one close to both the house they had shared and the buried trunk. The clincher is the sign Morris saw out front on his first reconnaissance. Call Thomas Sauber's Real Estate. If Peter's father is the selling agent, the boy could easily have filched a key. He seizes Tina by the arm and drags her across to the furnace, a huge and dusty relic crouched in the corner. She lets out another of those annoying cries as she tries to put weight on her swollen ankle and it buckles under her. He slaps her again. Shut up, he says. Stop being such a whiny bitch. There's enough computer core to make sure she stays in one place, but there's a cage light hanging on the wall with several yards of orange electrical cord looped around it. Morris doesn't need the light, but the cord is a gift from God. He didn't think he could be any angrier with the thief, but he was wrong. Jimmy Gold would like it, I bet, the thief had said. And what right did he have to reference John Rothstein's work? Rothstein's work was his. Turn around. Tina doesn't move quickly enough to suit Morris, who is still furious with her brother. He grabs her shoulders and whirls her. Tina doesn't cry out this time, but a groan escapes her tightly compressed lips. Her beloved yellow blouse is now smeared with basement dirt. He secures the orange electrical cord to the computer cord binding her wrists, then throws the cage light over one of the furnace pipes. He pulls the cord taut, eliciting another groan from the girl as her bound hands are jerked up almost to her shoulder blades. Morris ties off the new cord with a double knot, thinking they were here all along and he thinks that's funny. If he wants funny, I'll give him all the funny he can stand. He can die laughing. He bends down, hands on his knees, so he's eye to eye with the thief's sister. I'm going upstairs to get my property, girlfriend. Also to kill your pain in the ass, brother. Then I'm going to come back down and kill you. He kisses the tip of her nose. Your life is over. I want you to think about that while I'm gone. He trots toward the stairs. 52. Pete is in the pantry. The door is only open a crack, but that's enough to see red lips as he goes hustling by, the little red and black gun in one hand, Tina's phone in the other. Pete listens to the echo of his footfalls as they cross the empty downstairs rooms, and as soon as they become the thud, thud, thud of feet climbing the stairs to what was once known as the Saturday Movie Palace, he pelts for the stairs to the basement. He drops his shoes on the way. He wants his hands free. He also wants Red Lips to know exactly where he went. Maybe it will slow him down. Tina's eyes widen when she sees him. Pete, get me out of here! He goes to her and looks at the tangle of knots, white cord, orange cord, that binds her hands behind her and also to the furnace. The knots are tight, and he feels a wave of despair as he looks at them. He loosens one of the orange knots, allowing her hands to drop a little and taking some of the pressure off her shoulders. As he starts work on the second, his cell phone vibrates. The wolf has found nothing upstairs and is calling back. Instead of answering, Pete hurries to the box below the window. His printing is on the side. Kitchen Supplies. He can see footprints on top and knows to whom they belong.
What are you doing? Tina says. Untie me!
But getting her free is only part of the problem. Getting her out is the rest of it, and Pete doesn't think there's enough time to do both before Red Lips comes back. He has seen his sister's ankle, now so swollen it hardly looks like an ankle at all. Red Lips is no longer bothering with Tina's phone. He yells from upstairs, screams from upstairs.
Where are you, you fucking son of a whore?
Two little piggies in the basement and the big bad wolf upstairs, Pete thinks, and us without a house made of straw, let alone one made of bricks.
He carries the carton Red Lips used as a step to the middle of the room and pulls the folded flaps apart as footfalls race across the kitchen floor above them, pounding hard enough to make the old strips of insulation hanging between the beams sway a little. Tina's face is a mask of horror. Pete upends the carton, pouring out a flood of moleskin notebooks.
Pete, what are you doing? He's coming!
Don't I know it, Pete thinks, and opens the second carton. As he adds the rest of the notebooks to the pile on the basement floor, the footfalls above stop. He's seen the shoes. Red Lips opens the door to the basement, being cautious now, trying to think it through.
Peter, are you visiting with your sister?
Yes, Peter calls back. I'm visiting her with a gun in my hand.
You know what? The wolf says. I don't believe that.
Pete unscrews the cap on the can of lighter fluid and upends it over the notebooks, dousing the jack straw heap of stories, poems, and angry half-drunk rants that often end in mid-thought. Also the two novels that complete the story of a fucked-up American named Jimmy Gold stumbling through the 60s and looking for some kind of redemption. Looking for, in his own words, some kind of shit that means shit. Pete fumbles for the lighter, and at first it slips through his fingers. God, he can see the man's shadow up there now. Also the shadow of the gun. Tina is saucer-eyed with terror, hog-tied with her nose and lips slathered in blood. The bastard beat her, Pete thinks. Why did he do that? She's only a little kid. But he knows. The sister was a semi-acceptable substitute for the one Red Lips really wants to beat.
You better believe it, Pete says. It's a .45, lots bigger than yours. It was in my father's desk. You better just go away. That would be the smart thing.
Please, God, please. But Pete's voice wavers on the last words, rising to the uncertain treble of the 13-year-old boy who found these notebooks in the first place. Red Lips hears it, laughs, and starts down the stairs. Pete grabs the lighter again, tight this time, and thumbs up the top as Red Lips comes fully into view. Pete flicks the spark wheel, realizing that he never checked to see if the lighter had fuel, an oversight that could end his life and that of his sister in the next 10 seconds. But the spark produces a robust yellow flame. Peter holds the lighter a foot above the pile of notebooks.
You're right, he says. No gun. But I did find this in the desk.
53. Hodges and Jerome run across the baseball field. Jerome is pulling ahead, but Hodges isn't too far behind. Jerome stops at the edge of the sorry little basketball court and points to a green Subaru parked near the loading dock. Hodges reads the vanity license plate, "Books for You," and nods. They have just started moving again when they hear a furious yell from inside.
Where are you, you fucking son of a whore?
That's gotta be Bellamy. The fucking son of a whore is undoubtedly Peter Salbers. The boy let himself in with his father's key, which means the front door is open. Hodges points to himself, then to the wreck. Jerome nods, but says in a low voice,
You have no gun.
True enough, but my thoughts are pure and my strength is that of 10.
Huh?
Stay here, Jerome, I mean it.
You sure?
Yes, you don't happen to have a knife, do you? Even a pocket knife?
No, sorry.
All right, then look around. Find a bottle. There must be some. Kids probably come back here to drink beer after dark. Break it and then slash you some tires. If this goes sideways, he's not using Halliday's car to get away.
Jerome's face says he doesn't much care for the possible implications of this order. He grips Hodge's arm. No kamikaze runs, Bill, you hear me? Because you have nothing to make up for.
I know. The truth is, he knows nothing of the kind. 4 years ago, a woman he loved died in an explosion that was meant for him. There's not a day that goes by when he doesn't think of Janie. Not a night when he doesn't lie in bed thinking, if only I had been a little quicker, a little smarter. He hasn't been quick enough or smart enough this time either, and telling himself that the situation developed too quickly isn't going to get those kids out of the potentially lethal jam they're in. All he knows for sure is that neither Tina nor her brother can die on his watch today. He'll do whatever he needs to in order to prevent that from happening. He pats the side of Jerome's face. Trust me, kiddo, I'll do my part. You just take care of those tires. You might yank some plug wires while you're at it. Hodges starts away, looking back just once when he reaches the corner of the building. Jerome is watching him unhappily, but this time he's staying put, which is good. The only thing worse than Bellamy killing Peter and Tina would be if he killed Jerome. He goes around the corner and runs to the front of the building. This door, like the one at 23 Sycamore Street, is standing open.
54. Red Lips is staring at the heap of moleskin notebooks as if hypnotized. At last, he raises his eyes to Pete. He also raises the gun. Go ahead, Pete says. Do it and see what happens to the notebooks when I drop the lighter. I only got a chance to really douse the ones on top, but by now it'll be trickling down. And they're old, they'll go up fast. Then maybe the rest of the shit down here.
So, it's a Mexican standoff, Red Lips says. The only problem with that, Peter, I'm speaking from your perspective now, is that my gun will last longer than your lighter. What are you going to do when it burns out?
He's trying to sound calm and in charge, but his eyes keep ping-ponging between the Zippo and the notebooks. The covers of the ones on top gleam wetly, like sealskin.
I'll know when that's going to happen, Pete says. The second the flame starts to go lower and turns blue instead of yellow, I'll drop it. Then, poof!
You won't. The wolf's upper lip rises, exposing those yellow teeth, those fangs.
Why not? They're just words. Compared to my sister, they don't mean shit.
Really? Red Lips turns the gun on Tina. Then douse the lighter or I'll kill her right in front of you.
Painful hands squeeze Pete's heart at the sight of the gun pointing at his sister's midsection, but he doesn't close the Zippo's cap. He bends over very slowly, lowering it toward the pile of notebooks. There are two more Jimmy Gold novels in here. Did you know that?
You're lying. Red Lips is still pointing the gun at Tina, but his eyes have been drawn helplessly, it seems, back toward the moleskins again.
There's one. It's about him going west.
Two, Pete says again. The runner goes west is good, but the runner raises the flag is the best thing he ever wrote. It's long, too, an epic. What a shame if you never get to read it. A flush is climbing up the man's pale cheeks.
How dare you? How dare you bait me?
I gave my life for those books. I killed for those books. I know, Pete says. And since you're such a fan, here's a little treat for you. In the last book, Jimmy meets Andrea Stone again. How about that? The wolf's eyes widen.
Andrea? He does? How? What happens?
Under such circumstances, the question is beyond bizarre, but it's also sincere. Honest. Pete realizes that the fictional Andrea, Jimmy's first love, is real to this man in a way Pete's sister is not. No human being is as real to Red Lips as Jimmy Gold, Andrea Stone, Mr. Meeker, Pierre Raton, also known as the car salesman of doom, and all the rest. This is surely a marker of true, deep insanity. But that must make Pete crazy, too, because he knows how this lunatic feels. Exactly how. He lit up with the same excitement, the same amazement, when Jimmy glimpsed Andrea in Grant Park during the Chicago riots of 1968. Tears actually came to his eyes. Such tears, Pete realizes. Yes, even now. Especially now, because their lives hang upon it, mark the core power of make-believe. It's what caused thousands to weep when they learned that Charles Dickens had died of a stroke. It's why for years a stranger put a rose on Edgar Allan Poe's grave every January 19th, Poe's birthday. It's also what would make Pete hate this man, even if he wasn't pointing a gun at his sister's trembling, vulnerable midsection. Red Lips took the life of a great writer. And why? Because Rothstein dared to follow a character who went in a direction Red Lips didn't like? Yes, that was it. He did it out of his own core belief. That the writing was somehow more important than the writer.
Slowly and deliberately, Pete shakes his head. It's all in the notebooks. The runner raises the flag, fills 16 of them. You could read it there, but you'll never hear any of it from me.
Pete actually smiles. No spoilers.
The notebooks are mine, you bastard. Mine! They're going to be ashes if you don't let my sister go.
Petey, I can't even walk! Tina wails.
Pete can't afford to look at her, only at Red Lips. Only at the wolf.
What's your name? I think I deserve to know your name.
Red Lips shrugs as if it no longer matters. Morris Bellamy.
Throw the gun away, Mr. Bellamy. Kick it along the floor and under the furnace. Once you do that, I'll close the lighter. I'll untie my sister and we'll go. I'll give you plenty of time to get away with the notebooks. All I want to do is take Tina home and get help for my mom.
I'm supposed to trust you? Red Lips sneers it.
Pete lowers the lighter farther.
Trust me or watch the notebooks burn. Make up your mind fast. I don't know the last time my dad filled this thing.
Something catches the corner of Pete's eye. Something moving on the stairs. He doesn't dare look. If he does, Red Lips will too.
And I've almost got him, Pete thinks.
This seems to be so. Red Lips starts to lower the gun. For a moment, he looks every year of his age and more. Then he raises the gun and points it at Tina again.
I won't kill her!
He speaks in the decisive tone of a general who has just made a crucial battlefield decision.
Not at first. I'll just shoot her in the leg. You can listen to her scream. If you light the notebooks on fire after that, I'll shoot her in the other leg. Then in the stomach. She'll die. But she'll have plenty of time to hate you first if she doesn't already...
There's a flat double clap from Morris's left. It's Pete's shoes landing at the foot of the stairs. Morris, on a hair trigger, wheels in that direction and fires. The gun is small, but in the enclosed space of the basement, the report is loud. Pete gives an involuntary jerk, and the lighter falls from his hand. There is an explosive whoomp, and the notebooks on top of the pile suddenly grow a corona of fire.
No!
Morris screams, wheeling away from Hodges, even as Hodges comes pelting down the stairs so fast he can barely keep his balance.
Morris has a clear shot at Pete. He raises the gun to take it, but before he can fire, Tina swings forward on her bonds and kicks him in the back of the leg with her good foot.
The bullet goes between Pete's neck and shoulder. The notebooks, meanwhile, are burning briskly.
Hodges closes with Morris before he can fire again, grabbing at Morris's gun hand. Hodges is the heavier of the two and in better shape, but Morris Bellamy possesses the strength of insanity. They waltz drunkenly across the basement, Hodges holding Morris's right wrist so the little automatic points at the ceiling, Morris using his left hand to rip at Hodges' face, trying to claw at his eyes.
Pete races around the notebooks. They are blazing now, the lighter fluid that has trickled deep into the pile igniting, and grapples with Morris from behind. Morris turns his head, bares his teeth, and snaps at him. His eyes are rolling in their sockets.
His hand! Get his hand! Hodges shouts. They have stumbled under the stairs. Hodges' face is striped with blood, several pieces of his cheek hanging in strips.
Get it before he skins me alive!
Pete grabs Bellamy's left hand. Behind them, Tina is screaming. Hodges pounds a fist into Bellamy's face twice, hard, pistoning blows. That seems to finish him. His face goes slack and his knees buckle. Tina is still screaming, and the basement is growing brighter.
The roof, Petey! The roof is catching!
Morris is on his knees, his head hanging, blood gushing from his chin, lips, and broken nose. Hodges grabs his right wrist and twists. There's a crack as Morris's wrist breaks, and the little automatic clatters to the floor. Hodges has a moment to think it's over before the bastard rams his free hand forward and upward, punching Hodges squarely in the balls and filling his belly with liquid pain. Morris scuttles between his spread legs.
Hodges gasps, hands pressed to his throbbing crotch.
Petey! Petey! The ceiling!
Pete thinks Bellamy is going after the gun, but the man ignores it entirely. His goal is the notebooks. They are now a bonfire, the covers curling back. The page is browning and sending up sparks that have ignited several strips of hanging insulation. The fire begins spreading above them, dropping burning streamers. One of these lands on Tina's head, and there's a stench of frying hair to go with the smell of the burning paper and insulation. She shakes it away with a cry of pain. Pete runs to her, punning the little automatic deep into the basement as he goes. He beats at her smoldering hair and then begins struggling with the knots.
No!
Morris screams, but not at Pete. He goes to his knees in front of the notebooks like a religious zealot in front of a blazing altar. He reaches into the flames, trying to push the pile apart. This sends fresh clouds of sparks spiraling upward.
No, 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 no!
Hodges wants to run to Peter and his sister, but the best he can manage is a drunken shamble. The pain in his groin is spreading down his legs, loosening the muscles he has worked so hard to build up. Nevertheless, he gets to work on one of the knots in the orange electrical cord. He again wishes for a knife, but it would take a cleaver to cut this stuff. The shit is thick. More blazing strips of insulation fall around them. Hodges bats them away from the girl, terrified that her gauzy blouse will catch fire. The knot is letting go, finally letting go, but the girl is struggling. Stop, teens, Pete says. Sweat is pouring down his face. The basement is getting hot. They're slip knots. You're pulling them tight again. You have to stop. Morris's screams are changing into howls of pain. Hodges has no time to look at him. The loop he's pulling on abruptly loosens. He pulls Tina away from the furnace, her hands still tied behind her. There's going to be no exit by way of the stairs. The lower ones are burning and the upper ones are catching. The tables, the chairs, the boxes of stored paperwork, all on fire. Morris Bellamy is also on fire. Both his sport coat and the shirt beneath are blazing. Yet he continues to root his way into the bonfire, trying to get at any unburned notebook still left at the bottom. His fingers are turning black. Although the pain must be excruciating, he keeps going. Hodges has time to think of the fairy tale where the wolf came down the chimney and landed in a pot of boiling water. His daughter, Allison, didn't want to hear that one. She said it was too scary. Bill! Bill! Over here! Hodges sees Jerome at one of the basement windows. Hodges remembers saying, "Neither one of you minds worth a tinker's dam," and now he's delighted that they don't. Jerome is on his belly, sticking his arms through and down.
Lift her! Lift her up! Quick, before you all cook!
It's mostly Pete who carries Tina across to the basement window through the falling sparks and burning scarves of insulation. One lands on the kid's back, and Hodges swipes it away. Pete lifts her. Jerome grabs her under the arms and hauls her out, the plug of the computer cord Morris used to tie her hands trailing and bumping behind.
"Now you," Hodges gasps.
Pete shakes his head.
"You first."
He looks up at Jerome.
"You pull, I'll push."
"Okay," Jerome says.
"Lift your arms, Bill."
There's no time to argue. Hodges lifts his arms and feels them grabbed. He has time to think, feels like wearing handcuffs, and then he's being hoisted. It's slow at first. He's a lot heavier than the girl. But then two hands plant themselves firmly on his ass and shove. He rises into clear, clean air, hot but cooler than the basement, and lands next to Tina Salbers. Jerome reaches through again.
"Come on, kid, move it!"
Pete lifts his arms, and Jerome seizes his wrists. The basement is filling with smoke, and Pete begins coughing, almost retching, as he uses his feet to pedal his way up the wall. He slides through the window, turns over, and peers back into the basement. A charred scarecrow kneels in there, digging into the burning notebooks with arms made of fire. Morris's face is melting. He shrieks and begins hugging the blazing, dissolving remnants of Rothstein's work to his burning chest.
"Don't look at that, kid," Hodges says, putting a hand on his shoulder. "Don't."
But Pete wants to look, needs to look. He thinks, "That could have been me on fire." He thinks, "No, because I know the difference. I know what matters." He thinks, "Please God, if you're there, let that be true." 55. Pete lets Jerome carry Tina as far as the baseball field and says, "Give her to me, please." Jerome surveys him.
Pete's pale, shocked face, the one blistered ear, the holes charred in his shirt. You sure?
Yeah.
Tina is already holding out her arms. She has been quiet since being hauled from the burning basement, but when Pete takes her, she puts her arms around his neck, her face against his shoulder, and begins to cry loudly. Holly comes running down the path.
Thank God, she says. There you are. Where's Bellamy?
Back there in the basement, Hodges says. And if he isn't dead yet, he wishes he was. Have you got your cell phone? Call the fire department.
Is our mother okay? Pete asks.
I think she's going to be fine,
Holly says, pulling her phone off her belt.
The ambulance is taking her to Kiner Memorial. She was alert and talking. The paramedics said her vital signs are good.
Thank God, Pete says. Now he also starts to cry, the tears cutting clean tracks through the smears of soot on his cheeks. If she died, I'd kill myself, because this is all my fault.
No, Hodges says.
Pete looks at him. Tina is looking too, her arms still linked around her brother's neck.
You found the notebooks and the money, didn't you?
Yes, by accident. They were buried in a trunk by the stream. Anyone would have done what you did, Jerome says. Isn't that right, Bill?
Yes, Bill says. For your family, you do all that you can. The way you went after Bellamy when he took Tina.
I wish I'd never found that trunk, Pete says. What he doesn't say, will never say, is how much it hurts to know that the notebooks are gone. Knowing that burns like fire. He does understand how Morris felt, and that burns like fire, too. I wish it had stayed buried.
Wish in one hand, Hodges says, spit in the other. Let's go. I need to use an ice pack before the swelling gets too bad.
Swelling where? Holly asks. You look okay to me.
Hodges puts an arm around her shoulders. Sometimes Holly stiffens when he does this, but not today, so he kisses her cheek, too. It raises a doubtful smile.
Did he get you where it hurts, boys?
Yes, now hush. They walk slowly, partly for Hodges' benefit, partly for Pete's.
His sister is getting heavy, but he doesn't want to put her down. He wants to carry her all the way home.
After. Picnic.
On the Friday that kicks off the Labor Day weekend, a Jeep Wrangler, getting on in years but loved by its owner, pulls into the parking lot above the McGinnis Park Little League fields and stops next to a blue Mercedes that is also getting on in years. Jerome Robinson makes his way down the grassy slope toward a picnic table where food has already been set out. A paper bag swings from one of his hands. Yo, Hollyberry!
She turns. How many times have I told you not to call me that? 100? 1,000?
But she's smiling as she says it, and when he hugs her, she hugs back.
Jerome doesn't press his luck. He gives one good squeeze, then asks what's for lunch.
There's chicken salad, tuna salad, and coleslaw. I also brought a roast beef sandwich. That's for you if you want it. I'm off red meat. It upsets my circadian rhythms.
I'll make sure you're not tempted then.
They sit down. Holly pours Snapple into Dixie cups. They toast the end of summer and then munch away, gabbing about movies and TV shows, temporarily avoiding the reason they're here. This is goodbye, at least for a while.
Too bad Bill couldn't come, Jerome says as Holly hands him a piece of chocolate cream pie.
Remember when we all got together here for a picnic after his hearing? To celebrate that judge deciding not to put him in jail?
I remember perfectly well, Holly says. You wanted to ride the bus.
Because the bus be for free, Tyrone Feelgood exclaims. I takes all the for free I can get, Miss Holly.
You've worn that out, Jerome.
He sighs. I sort of have, I guess.
Bill got a call from Peter Saubers, Holly said. That's why he didn't come. He said I was to give you his best, and that he'd see you before you went back to Cambridge. Wipe your nose. There's a dab of chocolate on it.
Jerome resists the urge to say,
chocolate be my favorite color.
Is Pete all right?
Yes. He had some good news that he wanted to share with Bill in person. I can't finish my pie. Do you want the rest?
Unless you don't want to eat after me. I'm okay with that, but I don't have a cold or anything.
I'd even use your toothbrush, Jerome says, but I'm full.
Oof, Holly says. I'd never use another person's toothbrush.
She collects their paper cups and plates and takes them to a nearby litter barrel.
What time are you leaving tomorrow?
Jerome asks.
The sun rises at 6:55 a.m. I expect to be on the road by 7:30 at the latest.
Holly is driving to Cincinnati to see her mother, by herself. Jerome can hardly believe it. He's glad for her, but he's also afraid for her. What if something goes wrong and she freaks out?
Stop worrying, she says, coming back and sitting down. I'll be fine. All turnpikes, no night driving, and the forecast is for clear weather. Also, I have my three favorite movie soundtracks on CD. Road to Perdition, The Shawshank Redemption, and Godfather 2. Which is the best, in my opinion. Although Thomas Newman is, on the whole, much better than Nino Rota. Thomas Newman's music is mysterious.
John Williams, Schindler's List, Jerome says. Nothing tops it.
Jerome, I don't want to say you're full of shit, but actually you are.
He laughs, delighted.
I have my cell phone and iPad both fully charged. The Mercedes just had its full maintenance check, and really, it's only 400 miles.
Cool. But call me if you need to. Me or Bill.
Of course. When are you leaving for Cambridge?
Next week.
Done on the docks?
All done, and glad of it. Physical labor may be good for the body, but I don't feel that it ennobles the soul.
Holly still has trouble meeting the eyes of even her close friends, but she makes an effort and meets Jerome's.
Pete's all right, Tina's all right, and their mother is back on her feet. That's all good, but is Bill all right? Tell me the truth.
I don't know what you mean.
Now it's Jerome who finds it difficult to maintain eye contact.
He's too thin, for one thing. He's taken the exercise and salads regimen too far. But that's not what I'm really worried about.
What is?
But Jerome knows, and isn't surprised she knows, although Bill thinks he's kept it from her. Holly has her ways. She lowers her voice as if afraid of being overheard, although there's no one within 100 yards in any direction.
How often does he visit him?
Jerome doesn't have to ask who she's talking about. I don't really know.
More than once a month?
I think so, yes.
Once a week?
Probably not that often.
Although who can say?
Why? He's...
Holly's lips are trembling.
Brady Hartsfield is next door to a vegetable.
You can't blame yourself for that, Holly. You absolutely can't. You hit him because he was going to blow up a couple of thousand kids. He tries to touch your hand, but she snatches it away.
I don't. I do it again. Again, again, again. But I hate to think of Bill obsessing about him. I know from obsession, and it's not nice.
She crosses her arms over her bosom, an old self-comforting gesture that she has largely given up.
I don't think it's obsession, exactly.
Jerome speaks cautiously, feeling his way.
I don't think it's about the past.
What else can it be? Because that monster has no future.
Bill's not so sure, Jerome thinks, but would never say. Holly is better, but she's still fragile, and as she herself said, she knows from obsession. Besides, he has no idea what Bill's continuing interest in Brady means. All he has is a feeling, a hunch. Let it rest, he says. This time when he puts his hand over hers, she allows it to stay, and they talk of other things for a while. Then he looks at his watch. I have to go. I promised to pick up Barbara and Tina at the roller rink.
Tina's in love with you,
Holly says matter-of-factly as they walk up the slope to their cars.
If she is, it'll pass, he says. I'm heading east, and pretty soon some cute boy will appear in her life. She'll write his name on her book covers.
I suppose, Holly says. That's usually how it works, isn't it? I just don't want you to make fun of her. She'd think you were being mean and feel sad.
I won't, Jerome says. They have reached the cars, and once more Holly forces herself to look him full in the face.
I'm not in love with you, not the way she is, but I love you quite a lot, just the same. So take care of yourself, Jerome. Some college boys do foolish things. Don't be one of them.
This time it's she who embraces him.
Oh, hey, I almost forgot, Jerome says. I brought you a little present. It's a shirt, although I don't think you'll want to wear it when you visit your mom.
He hands her his bag. She takes out the bright red tee and unfolds it. Printed on the front in black, it shouts, "Shit don't mean shit." Jimmy Gold.
They sell them at the City College bookstore. I got it in an XL in case you want to wear it as a nightshirt.
He studies her face as she considers the words on the front of the tee. Of course, you can also return it for something else if you don't like it.
I like it very much, she says, and breaks into a smile.
It's the one Hodges loves, the one that makes her beautiful.
And I will wear it when I visit my mother, just to piss her off.
Jerome looks so surprised that she laughs.
Don't you ever want to piss your mother off?
From time to time. And Holly, I love you too. You know that, right?
I do, she says, holding the shirt to her chest. And I'm glad. That shit means a lot.
Trunk. Hodges walks the path through the undeveloped land from the Birch Street end and finds Pete sitting on the bank of the stream with his knees hugged to his chest. Nearby, a scrubby tree juts over the water, which is down to a trickle after a long, hot summer. Below the tree, the hole where the trunk was buried has been re-excavated. The trunk itself is sitting aslant on the bank nearby. It looks old and tired and rather ominous, a time traveler from a year when disco was still in bloom. A photographer's tripod stands nearby. There are also a couple of bags that look like the kind pros carry when they travel.
The famous trunk, Hodges says, sitting down next to Pete.
Pete nods.
Yeah, the famous trunk. The picture guy and his assistant have gone to lunch, but I think they'll be back pretty soon. Didn't seem crazy about any of the local restaurant choices. They're from New York.
He shrugs as if that explains everything.
At first the guy wanted me sitting on it with my chin on my fist, you know, like that famous statue. I talked him out of it, but it wasn't easy.
This is for the local paper?
Pete shakes his head, starting to smile.
That's my good news, Mr. Hodges. It's for the New Yorker. They want an article about what happened.
Not a little one, either. They want it for what they call the well, which means the middle of the magazine. A really big piece, maybe the biggest they've ever done.
That's great.
It will be if I don't fuck it up.
Hodges studies him for a moment. Wait. You're going to write it?
Yeah. At first they wanted to send out one of their writers, George Packer. He's a really good one, to interview me and write the story. It's a big deal because John Rothstein was one of their fiction stars in the old days, right up there with John Updike, Shirley Jackson. You know the ones I mean.
Hodges doesn't, but he nods.
Rothstein was sort of the go-to guy for teenage angst and then middle-class angst, sort of like John Cheever. I'm reading Cheever now. Do you know his story, The Swimmer?
Hodges shakes his head.
You should. It's awesome. Anyhow, they want the story of the notebooks. The whole thing, from beginning to end. This was after they had 3 or 4 handwriting analysts check out the photocopies I made and the fragments.
Hodges does know about the fragments. There were enough charred scraps in the burned-out basement to validate Pete's claim that the lost notebooks really had been Rothstein's work. Police backtrailing Morris Bellamy had further buttressed Pete's story, which Hodges never doubted in the first place.
You said no to Packer, I take it. I said no to anyone. If the story's going to get written, I have to be the one to do it. Not just because I was there, but because reading John Rothstein changed my...
He stops and shakes his head. No. I was going to say his work changed my life, but that's not right. I don't think a teenager has much of a life to change. I just turned 18 last month. I guess what I mean is, his work changed my heart.
Hodges smiles. I get that.
The editor in charge of the story said I was too young. Better than saying I had no talent, right? So I sent him writing samples. That helped. Also, I stood up to him. It wasn't all that hard.
Negotiating with a magazine guy from New York didn't seem like such a big deal after facing Bellamy.
That
was a negotiation.
Pete shrugs. They'll edit it the way they want, of course. I've read enough to know the process, and I'm okay with that. But if they want to publish it, it'll be my name over my story.
Tough stance, Pete. He stares at the trunk, for a moment looking much older than 18.
It's a tough world. I found that out after my dad got run down at City Center.
No reply seems adequate, so Hodges keeps silent.
You know what they want most at the New Yorker, right?
Hodges didn't spend almost 30 years as a detective for nothing. A summary of the last two books would be my guess. Jimmy Gold and his sister and all his friends. Who did what to who, and how, and when, and how it all came out in the wash.
Yeah, and I'm the only one who knows those things. Which brings me to the apology part.
He looks at Hodges solemnly. Pete, no apologies necessary. There are no legal charges against you, and I'm not bearing even a teensy grudge about anything. Holly and Jerome aren't either. We're just glad your mom and sis are okay.
They almost weren't. If I hadn't stonewalled you that day in the car, then ducked out through the drugstore, I bet Bellamy never would have come to the house. Tina still has nightmares.
Does she blame you for them?
Actually, no.
Well, there you are, Hodges says. You were under the gun, literally as well as figuratively. Halliday scared the hell out of you, and you had no way of knowing he was dead when you went to his shop that day. As for Bellamy, you didn't even know he was still alive, let alone out of prison.
That's all true, but Halliday threatening me wasn't the only reason I wouldn't talk to you. I still thought I had a chance to keep the notebook, see?
That's why I wouldn't talk to you,
and why I ran away. I wanted to keep them. It wasn't the top thing on my mind, but it was there underneath, all right. Those notebooks. Well, and I have to say this in the piece I write for the New Yorker. They cast a spell over me. I need to apologize because I really wasn't so different from Morris Bellamy.
Hodges takes Pete by the shoulders and looks directly into his eyes. If that were true, you never would have gone to the wreck prepared to burn them.
I dropped the lighter by accident, Pete says quietly. The gunshot startled me. I think I would have done it anyway if he'd shot Tina, but I'll never know for sure.
I know, Hodges says, and I'm sure enough for both of us.
Yeah?
Yeah. So how much are they paying you for this?
$15,000.
Hodges whistles.
It's on acceptance, but they'll accept it all right. Mr. Ricker is helping me, and it's turning out pretty well. I've already got the first half done in rough draft. I'm not much of fiction, but I'm okay at stuff like this. I could make a career of it someday. Maybe.
What are you going to do with the money? Put it in a college fund?
He shakes his head. I'll get to college one way or another. I'm not worried about that. The money is for Chapel Ridge. Tina's going this year. You can't believe how excited she is.
That's good, Hodges says. That's really good.
They sit in silence for a little while, looking at the trunk.
There are footfalls on the path and men's voices. The two guys who appear are wearing almost identical plaid shirts and jeans that still show the store creases. Hodges has an idea they think this is how everybody dresses in flyover country. One has a camera around his neck. The other is toting a second light.
How was your lunch? Pete calls as they teeter across the creek on the stepping stones.
Fine, the one with the camera says. Denny's, moon's over my hammy. The hash browns alone were a culinary dream. Come on over, Pete. We'll start with a few of you kneeling by the trunk. I also want to get a few of you looking inside.
It's empty, Pete objects.
The photographer taps himself between the eyes.
People will imagine. They'll think, what must it have been like when he opened that trunk for the first time and saw all those literary treasures, you know?
Pete stands up, brushing the seat of jeans that are much more faded and more natural looking.
Want to stick around for the shoot, Mr. Hodges? Not every 18-year-old gets a full-page portrait in the New Yorker next to an article he wrote himself.
I'd love to, Pete, but I have an errand to run.
All right. Thanks for coming out and listening to me.
Will you put one other thing in your story?
What?
That this didn't start with you finding the trunk. Hodges looks at it, black and scuffed, a relic with scratched fittings and a moldy top. It started with the man who put it there.
And when you feel like blaming yourself for how it went down, you might want to remember that thing Jimmy Gold keeps saying. Shit don't mean shit.
Pete laughs and holds out his hand.
You're a good guy, Mr. Hodges.
Hodges shakes. Make it Bill. Now go smile for the camera.
He pauses on the other side of the creek and looks back. At the photographer's direction, Pete is kneeling with one hand resting on the trunk's scuffed top. It is the classic pose of ownership, reminding Hodges of a photo he once saw of Ernest Hemingway kneeling next to a lion he bagged. But Pete's face holds none of Hemingway's complacent, smiling, stupid confidence. Pete's face says, I never owned this. Hold that thought, kiddo, Hodges thinks as he starts back to his car. Hold that thought.